It's spoiler in time. This is a special time, a time that is made by Cord Killers. It's the other show, Cord Killers, where we talk about all of the things you can watch, all the services you can use to watch them, all the devices you use. But this is the show where we've actually watched them and we get to talk about them. And this week, we're going to talk about Extras, episode 3 or 2?
3.
I can't
remember. 3.
Okay. Chernobyl, episode 4 of season 1, and Spider-Man, Far From Home. I'm Tom Merritt, and the man who tipped me off to the correct episode number for Extras is Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people. But before we get into all of that, we got to check in on our silly movie draft game.
I'm going to win the movie draft.
Ahead of John Trekker?
Calling it right now.
Oh, So for that to happen,
I am going to get $1.2 billion from $470 million of The Lion King. It, Chapter 2, is going to get less than $300 million. Toy Story 4 is going to only make $100 more million, and Team Sword and Laser will win this draft.
Where is this coming from? This confidence, this bravado. Wow. What insider sauce do you know about the Lion King movie?
Hakuna Matata, my friend.
Do you have a loved one who like works at Rotten Tomatoes or something?
I mean, I do. Yeah, I do.
Is that where this is coming from?
It's just a feeling. It's just I'm just calling my shot. The open bayou has it. I'm pointing to right field.
Okay, right on. Meanwhile,
like, it's good to have hope, Brian.
It does look like Frog Pants will not hold on to first place because, man, that re-release of Endgame did not perform as well as I think anybody had hoped. So in the meantime, John Trekker has It Chapter 2, and they are only $150 million behind Frog Pants. But man, $400 million for The Lion King. That's a bold, hoo boy. Wow.
Lion King doesn't come out this week. It comes out next week.
Yeah.
So I have a week to regret these words.
No.
So you're saying that Lion King is going to do the second best movie of the summer, just over Captain
it's
Marvel.
It's going to set the record for July.
And under... just over Captain Marvel, a huge, big Marvel pre-Endgame film.
Circle of Life, Bryce.
Okay.
How about that?
All right. There we go.
Meanwhile, I saw that trailer for Hobbs and Shaw. It was kind of fun to see them marketing it as a superhero movie. I mean, it's kind of silly and corny and campy. It looks silly and fun. It might be the first Fast and the Furious movie that I see in the theaters.
I would, if I see Hobbs and Shaw in the theater, which I very well might, that would be the first one for me too.
Yeah. Crazy. All right. What do we want to talk about first?
Well, let's go into Spider-Man Far From Home. And I think we should start with this email from Joe from Earth 1218, who says, I was so excited to prompt you to discuss the multiverse and timeline craziness after Spider-Man Far From Home trailer. And after watching the movie, would like to apologize for the flight of fancy I took you on because I forgot Mysterio's exact words and fell for the ridiculous story about alternate universe that the Imagineering department at Stark made up. With that out of the way, though, let's speculate. I'm curious about your reactions to Fury running a scroll-filled shield, or is it sword, now that it's in space, especially considering Brian's dislike for the revisioning of the scrolls in Captain Marvel. It looks like this will be the thread that pulls together the next phase. So what's the wild speculation on scroll timeline in the MCU? A couple of other fun thoughts. I watched Iron Man this weekend and noted two things. It's totally the same guy with the drones who got yelled at by Jebediah in the flashback. It's the same footage from Iron Man, not a CGI fix. And the stinger on Iron Man was just Fury mentioning the Avengers with no clue as to the big bad. So a lack of a big bad clue in Spider-Man Far From Home stinger is not that strange.
Yeah, but what is strange, and I guess we're going to begin our discussion of the movie with the post-credits scene. That seemed to be an utterly pointless reveal that did nothing to enhance the story and in fact only served to take something away from it. Then now I have to do the mental homework of going back and try to figure out how it affects things to know that that's not really Nick Fury the entire time. All that, I think I hated it. I think out of all of the MCU movies, I might have hated that post-credit sequence the most because it undercut such a major plot point of the entire show to, as best I could tell, absolutely no tangible benefit whatsoever.
What plot point do you feel like it undercut?
The fact that I spent the whole movie believing that that was Nick Fury playing Nick Fury the entire time. And the fact that, wow, well, this must be a big deal if Mysterio is able to cloud the mind of Nick Fury. And then it's like, psych, it's the dumbest Skrull he's fooling instead. Also, it was a Skrull for no Skrull related reasons. I hated it. What? Sell me on this. What good should I have felt about it?
You know, I never like to do that because I don't give a shit if you liked the Skrull part or not. If I liked it, you know, it's fine. But I don't want to persuade you to like it. If you hate it, you hate it, right? It didn't bother me, though, because I'm like, oh, that's the twist. So that wasn't him all along. And I'm looking forward. You're looking backward. And I'm not, that's not a criticism. You're looking backward and saying, wait a minute, I was taken. I don't like this feeling. I thought that this was more powerful than it was. That all makes sense to me. I'm looking forward and saying, huh, okay, so we've got Sword in space. That seems pretty obvious. And the Skrulls are working for Sword at the time. So that's helpful. So they can be in more places at once. What is he doing up there besides taking a vacation? Why else is he up there? I have all kinds of questions that now I'm curious to find out the answers to.
Yeah. I don't know.
Again, I'm not trying to sell you. I'm saying this is where my head was at. It did also make me go like, wait, is everything consistent? Because that really felt like Nick Fury. But it didn't undermine it for me that Mysterio was able to cloud the Skrull, because he's Mysterio. It's the bigger deal is that he was able to trick Spider-Man into giving him the device from Tony Stark.
Sure.
And that remains untouched by this. That remains unaffected by this.
Yeah. I just hate that I was handed a bunch of homework and I have to do mental gymnastics the next time
you
watch
the whole
thing.
You don't have to. Just accept it.
Yeah. Okay. let me put it this way. I feel like it's a better story if it's actually Nick Fury. And to have it not be Nick Fury, I don't see why that's a better story at all. To me, the
best part of this movie is that you have Spider-Man believably not wanting to be a part of the Avengers anymore, which is the opposite of the last time we saw him. You see him believably tricked. If you don't know anything about Mysterio going into this movie, they played it perfectly. He seems like, hey, I'm the only guy who understands you. I'm on your side. I'm from another universe. We all know about multiple universes now from Endgame, right? Like, it was so well done. And that moment of betrayal where he walks out of the bar and they turn off the holograph is just, it's just gorgeous. It's a gorgeous reveal that, again, if you weren't already expecting it because you know the character of Mysterio, you're gasping. I think they totally pulled the wool over your eyes. I don't think that, you know, the Nick Fury thing changes that.
Sure. Let's put a pin in the Nick Fury thing, because to be honest, I don't even want to think about it. But I do want to sing the praises of what a great way to bring in a classic Spider-Man villain. To my delight, of the six people that we brought to the theater that day, I was the only one who knew who Mysterio was from the comic book. So as a result, as you can imagine, the whole first act, I had a very different experience from everybody else. Started to get a little bit antsy, like, okay, get to what I can clearly see you're doing here. And then
what is it going to be? Like, he's lying. We all know he's lying. What exactly is he lying about? That's where I was.
Well, for me, it's like, hey, I've read the comics. I know who Mysterio is. Also, I saw a little movie called The Incredibles. And so I know Syndrome's tricks. So we get it. You're doing Syndrome with Mysterio. Get to the part where we realize he is the villain. And then the moment that happens, I loved it. I was on board with everything else. In the meantime, I thought it was so much fun to be everything from that are they intentionally being bad in the beginning? And then you realize, oh my God, they're definitely intentionally doing a bad beginning. And it was amazing to, I like that it was a small scale story. I like that it begins with sort of a shrug and teenagers saying like, yeah, 9/11 happened, but that was like 6 months ago. Now we're more concerned with this thing. It, like, all of that felt so believable. I like that it was emotionally focused, relationship focused. I like that they acknowledged the age gap in people. But all of that pales in comparison to my delight with how they introduced the idea of the courtship of Aunt May with Happy Hogan. That was That was so much fun, like beyond words.
Both courtships are great to me in this movie. The courtship of Spider-Man or Peter Parker and MJ felt very believable, right? It's like, okay, this feels more like what a real high school situation is rather than the stereotypes you often see. But that it was still expected, right? It was still like, okay, but you know, that's kind of what you want to do. The happy and Aunt May thing, like from the beginning, you know, I bet some people didn't pick up the first clue, but Eileen and I just immediately looked at each other like, okay, this is interesting. Are they going to play this out? And they did. It was great.
Agreed. 100% agreed. And man, Marissa Tomei, boy, is she great. Just playing herself, essentially. Like that's how I would imagine she is in real life. Just that awesome and rolling with all the bunches.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. It was a movie that was tightened in scope. You wouldn't have had to have any connections to other Marvel movies, I think, to make this good. But the ones that they had did sort of flesh it out. I also like the way they just over-treated the Tony Stark thing.
You know, just like despite him not being in the movie, you felt with every mural and every place they went, the world felt his absence.
Well, there's more than Peter Parker. Legitimate approach, but also I felt like they were saying, look, a bunch of people are going to go like, yeah, but what's Peter going to do without Tony Stark? You know, who's going to be the Tony Stark? And they're like, you know who the Tony Stark in this movie is? The memory of Tony Stark. Here he is. He's on the bulletin board. He's on a wall. He's everywhere. Don't stop missing Tony Stark. He is in this. You don't need to. Here's plenty of Tony Stark left. I liked that.
I also enjoyed the moment where you saw Peter Parker step into being Iron Man Jr., where it's like he just got to work doing Tony Stark stuff, and he was like, I don't have time.
Smile and
I don't have time to self doubt myself. I got to design a brand new spider suit and then let's get started.
And had him step into that role in a slow and believable way rather than just kind of, you know, thrusting, well, you have to fill in now, Peter. Okay, I guess I will. Like they brought him along naturally to where he's this is what I do. And I'm going to do it my way. I'm not going to be Tony Stark. I can't be Tony Stark.
It was fairly tantric in the Campbellian story circle that 90% of the movie was him refusing the call until finally he's like, okay, fine, I'll be Iron Man. And of course that moment going all the way back to, of course, the beginning of the MCU with Iron Man, when you broke from the canonical story of the comic book and you have Tony Stark saying, yeah, screw it, I am Iron Man, right? That is echoed when we get to see J.K. Simmons in his first appearance in the MCU as Alex Jones, J. Jonah Jameson, outing him, which who knows, you know, maybe he just convinces the world like, what? No, that's crazy.
How can it be me? Yeah, right. But it also like the big Spider-Man trope, by the way, bringing him back as J. Jonah Jameson is a stroke of genius, right? Like there's the multiverse aspect that they could make some play with, but he's just really good at that role. And so I'm really glad.
Well, and plus also a huge debt of gratitude goes to the video game, because I believe J.K. Simmons was the voice of J. Jonah Jameson in the PlayStation video game doing essentially a podcast version of, and through between the lines, you hear the story of how he used to be editor in chief of the Daily Bugle. Now he's an independent product, so he can bring you the real truth and to just have him show up fully realized.
Actually,
as Alex. Oh, was it not him?
It might have been Darren DePaul.
Okay. Well, regardless,
but it was the character. They kept the feel.
Yeah,
pretty much. Him. Okay.
Yeah.
Because it does change the dynamic, which is Peter Parker works for him and has to get, because he can get pictures of Spider-Man, and has to hide the fact that he's Spider-Man because he hates Spider-Man. We're not going to get that dynamic probably if he knows Peter Parker is Spider-Man.
Well,
right?
I feel like this universe, they've never met. He's just a wacko on the internet.
Right.
Who's been given this story. They'll never be friends and we'll never see that dynamic.
Unless that's a plot point in a future Spider-Man movie, is Peter Parker, in order to prove he is not Spider-Man, gets pictures and video or exclusive things for him and then is able to hide himself that way.
I don't know, man. When you're heir to
gymnastics, but you can make it work.
Now that our current Peter Parker is heir to Tony Stark's godlike network of technology, I don't see why he would go to a newspaper and try to be a photographer.
In order to hide, it's the only way for him to like disabuse that public notion that he's Spider-Man in order to hide his identity.
I guess. I don't know. That seems like an awful big stretch for me to go. But
I don't know. You're the one who likes The Incredibles. And
wait, what?
I got nothing else. I do like this. I like this movie a lot. I thought it was really great.
Yeah, I did too. It was a lot of fun. Pacing was great. The character work was extraordinary. It was quaint and wonderful. Still don't know what you get out of Nick Fury. Why would you do that? Okay, all right.
You're letting, you know, the fly that buzzed over your cake ruin your cake.
Well, don't let that happen. And you're correct. And that's a really good way to put it, because I am looking at a beautiful cake, and for whatever reason, there's a fly on it, and it's hard for me to see anything but the fly. But it's a beautiful cake.
It was. Yeah, I did. I gave this amazing on my scale. Like I came out of the theater literally like, that was amazing.
Tom, you are not the first to call it an amazing Spider-Man. Come on.
It was a Spider-Man movie that was amazing. All right. Anything else on Spider-Man?
No, it's great. Everyone should see it.
Let's go to Chernobyl 104, which by all accounts, most people feel is the hardest episode. I agree and disagree. On the one hand, as a dog owner, hate this episode, right? Because I don't want to have to see that. But then that's no different than being a parent and, you know, seeing children hurt and killed. So I bracket that off and like, yes, but this really happened and they're telling a story. Outside of that kind of emotional jarring part of it, I did think that this was kind of in line as far as the amount of trauma you go through watching it. I didn't think it ramped it up that much other than the pet related stuff.
This will not be a very popular take, but I felt nothing during this. It was like, I am so invested in the, how do you save the planet side of things that I'm like, yeah, of course you kill the dogs. Why are we spending? Yeah, no, of course you cover them in cement. What are you going to not do that? Yeah, you're going to let everybody die? It's like I actually got angry at some point. I'm like, would you sons of bitches grow up? Would you do the things that need to be done? Because we've spent up until this nothing but genuine heroes doing the hard things that need to be done in the face of a global catastrophe. And to invest so much time in, oh, gee whiz, but dogs had to die. I'm sorry if I'm feeling nothing for this, because the adults are busy saving the world. And as a result, I kind of got annoyed with this. I did love that we got to the end and they flat out said, well, let's talk about why this thing exploded and the complicated decision of, you now have an opportunity to stand up to a megaphone and tell the world, and in so doing, save more lives. But you are also in Soviet Russia, and these are the very real practicalities. By the way, don't forget your character commits suicide in the very first episode, so we're pretty sure we know where this is headed.
Well, he might have committed suicide because of radiation poisoning. That's the other part of this. Nevertheless, whether you decide that like, oh, well, he must tell the truth and then kill himself or not, it's really attractive to me, the option provided of, look, the only reactors that have this problem are here in the Soviet Union. You tell a version of the truth in Vienna so that a nation that is obsessed with not being humiliated doesn't get humiliated. Then we make sure that all of these problems are fixed on the hush hush. Like, everybody wins, right? Win-win scenario. What's wrong with that, Brian?
To be honest, it kind of sounded pretty reasonable to me, except for they did a great job.
You have to trust the KGB.
Exactly. I did like that they're all like, you listen to those words you just said. Right. Make a deal with the KGB.
Yeah.
Just roll that around in your head for a little bit. And that to me is the heart of when Chernobyl is at its best. It makes me comprehend. And it's also what I liked about Counterpart. You know, we've talked about that many times. So that was the part that was most attractive to me.
Yeah. I felt like, yes, the part where they're showing them eliminating the dogs, you could, if you focus on that as like, oh, what they're trying to make me feel is bad for the dogs, I could see where that could annoy you. If you're like, yeah, I know, but it had to be done. Why are you torturing me by making me watch it? I felt like the other part of it, and probably the more important part of it, was showing the slow callousness that was developed by Pavel. He's like, I'm not in the military. And it was really meant to show you the human side of what the people who were carrying out these kinds of orders had to deal with. And that way, I actually did feel like it was effective.
And just how many people had to have gone through this process of giving their lives because of the react, you know, he just assumed it was soldiers, but they're out of soldiers, you know, yeah. And so now they've got
well,
kids.
And not every soldier was being a valiant miner risking the radiation or going into the building. Others were traumatized in other ways. And I thought it was good that they showed another way that people had to deal with this.
I also found myself weirdly respecting the pragmatism of sending humans to go clean up the graphite, where it's just like, this is your defining moment. This is you saving the world. Sure. 90 seconds, get in, get out. That's it.
Yeah.
And the ambiguousness, the not knowing of, okay, well, what years did I just trade for that? And because like, and I'm certain I haven't timed it, but I am certain that it was exactly 90 seconds that we watched somebody run out, trip over stuff, pick up, what did he pick up, 3 rocks and throw them over an edge? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was, and the weird part is it was quite possibly the most significant thing that person did in their entire life.
Yeah.
So, I liked that part. And there's something about that sound of the Geiger counter, we are accustomed to a certain level of clickiness, yeah. And instead
it kept ratcheting up and
it's
up.
It's just a nickel on a vinyl record. up and
when
down.
He, when he gets near to the edge, it just became static. Just yeah. Like
and we've not heard that because right. At some point it ceases to sound to our ears like a Geiger clicking. Counter. Right, exactly. Right, right. So as a result, in storytelling, we almost never hear that sound. So that makes it all the more potent in Chernobyl.
It was our main, the lead investigator, he was the one who suggested the biorobot sending the humans in. Is this the first time he's made the proposal to, you know, solve something with human lives?
I do perceive.
No, the sending the guys in the water to go in and shut the valve,
and also okay. The miners and all that. But yeah. I do agree that what we're seeing is the very yes, first Legasa. Episode. We have two characters: one who understands and speaks the party politics, right. Another who understands and speaks science and radiation, and we're seeing the two of them meet in the middle to where, right. You know, it has been really fun to experience them each becoming more like the other and yeah. Understanding the
other party,
practicalities.
Because the other party member and the other advisor that they bring in, neither of them considered humans at all up
right.
Until Legasov brings it up.
And then Legasov is just like, well, I know what'll do it. And here we go.
Well, here's this is probably means nothing, but it was interesting to me as someone who learned Russian in college. Robota is the Russian word for work. It is the same root Slavic word of Robotnik, which is the word in the Czech play that coined the term that became robot.
Right. Also, the bad guy in Sonic the Hedgehog.
Right. Of
yeah.
course. And so having them in Russian, you know, in my head, they're speaking Russian. Say, we'll use human workers in the workers state of the Soviet Union as robots. Which I don't know. It all played really nicely in my head as kind of an intricate form of elegant wordplay.
Yeah.
And especially because of the dehumanization that robots usually have and the dehumanization of the worker as a cog of the state. And in this case, that's necessary. There's just so much going on there. I thought that was pretty, even if it's not a real true conversation, I thought it was really well done.
We also got the end of the pregnant wife storyline, what I think is probably going to be the end of that pregnant wife storyline.
Yeah. She's in the preview for next week. So I think we get the resolution next week, but
to be honest, I was kind of, this is going to sound weird. I was kind of disappointed that she was actually pregnant. Because sure. Originally I thought that she was just telling a wonderful lie to her dying husband that we're going to have a baby or whatever. And I found that very heart Tuggy. And then it turns out that she was actually pregnant. And then I got mad at her because if you're actually pregnant, it's one thing to defy all of the rules of the nurses, you know, so that you could comfort your husband.
Sure.
And then in up to and telling him, oh, I'm even pregnant. Everything's great. Oh, God, you're melting. I'm doing this, you know, to make your last moments as nice as possible. Mm-hmm. But then when I find out she's actually pregnant, I'm like, that's awful. Shame on you. What are you doing?
But at that point, I mean, they were not telling her about radio. They, you know,
I thought we knew she was pregnant from episode one. And maybe I'm just imagining.
She said that, but I thought she was lying.
Oh, you just, okay. You thought she was an unreliable narrator.
Yeah. I thought that's the kind of thing you say when your husband's body is melting in front of you.
No, my interpretation of it. I thought we knew it from like the first, before he was melting, like before he left to go do the firefighting. I thought they alluded to it.
I didn't remember that either, if that's the case.
But whatever. Yeah. Even if it wasn't the case, the point was radiation is invisible. If you're not highly educated, you don't understand what it means. And if someone says you need to stay away from your husband, it'll hurt, you know, and are you pregnant? And you're like, if I say yes, she's gonna not let me see my husband, you say no. Right? It's yes, if she knew about radiation and its effects and did it anyway, that's horrible and awful. But I didn't get the impression that that was the decision she made. The decision she made was, I know that the bureaucrats want to keep me from my husband. I will say whatever I need to get to him. I don't see any threat.
Sure. I resented that I had a reason to not blindly think that she was awesome. Like all of a sudden I had to think back. I'm like, oh man, you really were pregnant and you did that? Like, that's not how I wanted to.
But she didn't do anything wrong, is what my point is. To her, what's radiation? Like, you're condemning her for her ignorance at that point.
Sure, yeah. That is an accurate assessment. I condemn her.
It's a tragedy, not necessarily intentional negligence.
Like, she was, up until that moment when I found out that she was really for reals pregnant, she was one of the most sympathetic characters. And then all of a sudden I'm like, now you're less sympathetic. you should have listened. Be back. Whatever. Anyway,
Batman Brian watching HBO.
Dogs. They shot a lot of dogs this episode.
Dogs, huh?
We got an email from David in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin, who says, hey, guys, also to Jackie somewhere in the chat room. That's nice. I'm calling it Jackie. He was glad we've watched it week to week and not binged on it. He says, without a doubt, episode 4 is the bleakest and darkest episode of the season. So he agrees with that. He says that he believes that Brian is not watching or listening to the podcast with co-host Craig Mazin. I am not either, by the way, but in this podcast, apparently, Craig admits, as painful as some of the scenes were, they didn't show everything that really happened back then, including some, you know, killing of dogs that weren't dead. So that whole point where the guy's like, you shoot them until they're dead, we don't let them suffer. Apparently that didn't really happen. Craig also had a discussion on West German drone use at Chernobyl. I think he means the robot, the automatic robot, mainly that it was real and it's still there because it's radioactive. An unintentional funny scene for Dave was when Boris makes the phone call and breaks the phone. He says, if nobody liked this episode, I'll understand. I can assure you episode 5 will not be the gut punch or as depressing as episode 4. As my coworker's mom, who was in Ukraine when the Chernobyl disaster happened, said, this is heavy. She said it several times as she watched episode 4 with the family. One thing I'm possibly mistaken on, Brian has taken jabs at Tom, claiming he mocked him for wanting X-ray features he loves on Amazon Prime with every streaming service instead of just using IMDb. I'm certain I typed use IMDb live in the chat room 2 months ago. So despite Tom admitting it sounds like something he'd say, I'm pretty sure I typed saying that to Brian.
I'm pretty certain that, yes, he typed that. I'm certain you read it, and I'm certain you dished it up to me, because I do remember.
I can't imagine that I backed away and said, this isn't my opinion, but Dave says. That's not what happened. But to concede Brian's point, IMDb is more clunky and less appealing than Amazon X-ray. So there you go, Dave.
Yeah. Hey, man, I guess, anyway, Chernobyl continues to be good. This episode, everyone was acting like was going to be hard. It didn't feel that hard.
I think people telling me it was going to be hard made it much like, oh, okay, we're following a kid and he's going to have to grow into this duty very quickly. And
I think it helped ensure us against how hard this episode was, because I'm like, oh, I know where this is going. There's going to be a lot of dog shot. Okay. I'm girding my loins. I'm ready for that. Wow. And it was not an easy episode even, you know, by any stretch.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, it is Chernobyl, for goodness sake. Let's talk about Extras, episode 3. Of course, this is the third, because it's the first time we get like a movie star as our guest appearance. I guess last week Vinny was a movie star, but this is like a big star.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Ben Stiller would have other words to say. He would remind you of the opening weekend of Meet the Fockers.
I guess what I'm thinking is Ben Stiller was acting as a director in his appearance.
Sure. But this is somebody
playing
themselves.
Vinny was on a different set. This is the first time where we're getting the major star of the show. Well, and I guess last week we did have the major star having a problem too. But come on. I mean, we're talking about
But also,
about a big
look,
star.
Look, like you're burying the lead here. How much fun is it to see Potty Mouth Kate Winslet? Potty Mouth Kate Winslet was a total blast.
Yeah, and so well used, right? She's like, well, you do this kind of. I don't want to do another Holocaust movie, but you do it to get an Oscar, right? Like, I'm sure that Kate Winslet has probably never said that, but she definitely knows people who have said those exact words.
Yeah, and I don't know, so many themes. It's neat to see them play in transgressive waters, and yet somehow keep Ricky Gervais as somewhat redeemable, or like as awkward as it is, you know, with meeting the girl whose sister has CP and all that stuff. Yeah. I mean, it felt like at the end of the day, I could still hug everyone.
Unlike
The Office, where I just wanted to punch people.
He just was honest when he's like, well, because she said that, and I just didn't feel right, you know, trying to, well, you know, like. Ricky Gervais in Extras makes me cringe, but he doesn't make me hate him.
Yeah. And this is also, what's the new love interest with his friend? Tug on it. Maybe I'm inventing a B plot that wasn't there, but, regardless, I mean, what's funny is like the bright shining star of Kate Winslet in A Potty Mouth is just overshadows everything.
Yeah, and we still follow the beats. He still wants to get lines, although he really doesn't try to hit up Kate Winslet for lines in this. So there's a little bit of a derivation.
Oh, that's right. He fakes being Catholic, even after flatly stating his hardcore atheism at the beginning of it. We watch him instantly compromise himself with the opportunity to
showing
date.
Up at the and that was the saving grace is he. David Brent would have never admitted he wasn't Catholic, right? David Brent, and despite all of the evidence against him, would have just said, no, I'm Catholic, I'm Catholic, I'm Catholic, all the way to the end, and you would have hated him. Ricky Gervais in Extras is like, yeah, no, I just made it up.
I do like some of the weird aside moments when he's just casually asking one of the set dressers, where he's like, so this giant Nazi banner. Wait, you just go down to the Nazi banner store and buy one of these? What? How does this happen? Which is great because, you know, he's obviously talking in the context of an extra on set. But also it's like, that's definitely an actual giant Nazi banner. Where did the BBC get that? How do they do
well,
all that?
Well, and it's the BBC, right? How many war period films have they done? They probably have a closet. Just all that stuff ready to roll out. Yeah.
It's funny how careful they are to choreograph all, or to catalog all that stuff. For example, when I did Halloween Horror Nights 2007, so it was like 12 years ago, part of the reason I was there was because they had like a wacky carnival midway. And so they made a bunch of old style carnival midway banners. And there was one that was technically not Brian Brushwood, but very clearly Brian Brushwood, because it was a blonde dude with spikes eating fire and all that stuff. And I was like, oh my God, this is great. And I was like, what are you guys going to do with this? Can I have this? But because it's Universal Studios, they've now somewhere an artist had to make that. And now it goes in their giant bank with a computerized catalog, where at some point somebody's going to make a movie under the Universal banner, and they're going to need it to look like a midway. And so that can be one of the items that shows up over there. So it goes in the catalog.
Yeah, that's cool. By the way, I just stumbled across this fact right now. When the Extras series was first shown in North America, back in 2005.
Oh.
The Kate Winslet episode that we watched this week was the first episode shown.
Was it?
Ben Stiller was second, and then Ross Kemp and Vinnie Jones were third.
How about that?
Yeah.
That's interesting because I don't remember seeing it that way. I wonder if it was different. Oh, you know what? I bet it was. This would have been back in the days when I was pirating. So I bet that I got them listed.
You probably got the UK version.
Yeah, I got the BBC ordered. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So quite an enjoyable time and well handled and hilarious and really enjoying Extras.
Yep. Good. I'm glad you're enjoying it. Not going to lie. Hope I don't overset this up. Just counting down the episodes till you get to the Patrick Stewart one. That's the
great the last one of the season, right? Episode six of series one. Okay. Very good. Well, thank you everyone for watching or listening, for supporting us on Patreon, patreon.com/cordkillers. You get spoiler in time a little earlier if you're a patron. So I hope you appreciate that. And we will spoil you again next week.
Also after talk.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.